Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, why the best writers risk being strange. And, you know, we really are going to talk about one of the best writers today. We're going to talk about William Shakespeare and Sonnet 130, which I would argue is an experimental poem. So I'll get into sort of that argument. In many respects, I consider Sonnet 130, which is the one that begins with "My mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun." So that's a very famous sonnet by Shakespeare. It is a sonnet that I think often gets misread as a love poem. I'll talk a bit about how it is a love poem. But I think in many respects, what it really is a meta poem, a poem about poems, a poem about poets, a poem criticizing poets, a poem declaring Shakespeare in some ways the greatest of all poets. I'm not saying that Shakespeare is, but I think that's the argument of the poem. Is that Shakespeare is the argument of the poem. You have this kind of, you know, brilliant little poem joke where it begins being written as if Shakespeare didn't know how to write a poem, didn't understand what poems were. He's taking everything too literally. He's confused why other poets are saying certain things. He doesn't really understand. He's trying to write a poem, but he can't say those things because, of course, they're not true. He's talking as if he doesn't know what a metaphor is. He's talking like he doesn't know what a simile or literary idea is. It's a really interesting joke setup, and he kind of continues it. I'm going to almost go through the poem in a pretty intense manner where I'm going to kind of walk through some of the core ways you would look at any poem. So I'm going to use it as an example of how you might analyze a poem. Or even to some degree, a literary text. I think a really important thing if you're going to be a writer is you need to learn how to read differently. There's a way of reading that you read if you're just reading for fun, and there's a different way of reading if you're trying to analyze something as an academic or as a writer. And I'm going to, in some ways, use this Shakespeare poem as an example of how you could read differently. Like, I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about the process of reading differently. So I'm going to use this example, but what I'm saying with it is going to apply to just the broader case of your reading something, a literary text in a more analytical manner, the kind of way you would approach it if you're trying to learn something from it as a writer. Again, Shakespeare's a great person to learn from because Shakespeare, whatever you want to say about Shakespeare, you know, there's things I like about Shakespeare, there's things I don't. The critics of Shakespeare often miss the success of Shakespeare. And what I mean by that is people will literally use words Shakespeare invented to claim he's not a good writer without realizing it. You know, they have this, you know, when you talk about your eyeball, you're quoting Shakespeare, who invented the word eyeball. You know, he wasn't, in many ways, Milton was a more influential writer than Shakespeare. Milton, for example, invented more words that we use today than Shakespeare did. But, you know, at the same time, you can't deny the influence and the power of Shakespeare, even if you don't want to admit that he is flawless, which I wouldn't. I think Shakespeare has written bad plays, for example. Romeo and Juliet is a play that I think is terrible in many ways. But, you know, starting to get into my opinion, I'll acknowledge, of course, that it is better than most plays, even though I don't think it's particularly good in certain ways. Sonnet 130 is its own brilliant little sonnet. I think it's an unconventional, almost experimental approach to the sonnet. Shakespeare was an innovator of the sonnet form. But also this particular poem is an example of a blazon. This type of poetry we don't write so much anymore, which I'll talk a bit about. And it's an experimental take on the blazon. But again, mostly what I'm trying to get at here is here's an example of how and a process by which you can read a bit more analytically so that you can learn from, you know, other writers and bring those tricks and tips into your own writing. And if you want tips and tricks about writing, go to strangeinc.ca, sign up for my newsletter. What you'll find there in that newsletter is my recommendations about things you could read or watch or what have you. You'll find writing tips, and I'll even share some of my draft writing with you. This is my personal kind of private email that I'm sending out these newsletters from. You can reply right to it, tell them what you think, tell me, you know, if you've got a different take on Shakespeare. It's a good way for us to keep in touch, and a good place to get kind of my tips and recommendations. So sign up at strangeink.ca, and let's dive in to Shakespeare's Sonnet 130. We're going to look at William Shakespeare's Sonnet 130, which is also known by its first line. This is an untitled poem, so we sometimes will use the untitled poem's first line as its title. That's a sort of convention in English studies. My mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. So I'm just going to read the poem to you, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that we would have to consider if we're going to analyze this poem or any poem. And as we're doing this, we're going to focus on the form and the content and how those two things are connecting and sometimes, you know, mirroring and supporting each other, and other times operating at that ironic level where one is undercutting the other. Typically, what we'll see is the form undercutting the content. So first, I'm just going to read the poem again. This is by William Shakespeare. Shakespeare lived in 1564 to 1616. Those are the dates. When he lived, he wrote about 150. He wrote 154 sonnets that we, you know, have. And I'll get into what a sonnet is and sort of why we would even bother to notice that shortly. But I'll just gonna read first the poem. But the thing that's important to keep in mind here, again, is that this is written hundreds of years ago. Even though it is in English, it is written hundreds of years ago. And so there are particular things that we have to keep in mind and some research that we would actually have to do if we want to try to understand what this thing is. Where we're starting with a poem like this, or with any poem, is again not, you know, what does it mean, which is a complex question that takes a lot of background to figure out. What we want to start with is just, what is this thing? You know, again, start to describe before you begin to analyze. Let's just start with the description. So first thing we're going to do is read the poem. My mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun. If hair be wires, black wires grow on her head. I've seen roses damask'd red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she walks, trids on the ground. And yet, by heaven, I think my love is rare as any she belied with false compare. So, where do we start with a poem like this? I think Shakespeare in particular, but also poetry in general, can become and seem very intimidating. It can seem difficult to understand where we should start when we're, you know, trying to understand a poem like this. I think the best way to think about anything that you're trying to understand is just begin with the simple question of, what is this thing that I'm even looking at? We know a few things about it. We know it's a poem. We'll get into a little bit later what a poem even is. But this is a poem, and that's something that's very worth keeping in mind. This is not something that is not a poem. It is a particular thing that has a particular set of conventions. There are normal ways in which poems operate. And if we just become aware of those ways, that we don't have to worry about it being intimidating. Something that becomes a complication here is the language itself, because we don't use the language in this particular way anymore. Some of these words that we do still use, but we don't use in the same manner. The simplest example here is perhaps the word she. At the end of this poem, when he writes, and yet by heaven I think my love is rare as any she belied with false compare. There are a few things happening in that particular last line. Compare. He's using a word we do still have in English, compare, but he's using it in a way we no longer use it in English, which is to make a comparison. Now, we say, I'll compare apples and I'll compare oranges, but we don't say,
oranges and apples, you know, are put side by side in a compare. We say comparison. So Shakespeare, you know, was using the word compare in the way that we use the word comparison. Now there's two words basically to mean two different but related things, whereas, you know, he's using the one in place of the other. That's fine and normal and dandy for Shakespeare. He's not trying to do anything strange there, but it's just not how we talk anymore. The word she is another word that is... So when he says false compare, just to kind of back up, he means false comparison. We would say false comparison. Shakespeare's saying false compare. We don't say that phrase anymore. The more sneaky one is she. In fact, this is where you get into a lot of problems, potentially, when you're reading older poems. A word like she, which sounds very sensible, you know, I think my love is rare as any she belied with false compare. Well, he's using the word she, which is still a word we'd like to use, but he's not using it in the same way that we would normally use it. So there's different ways that, of course, you know, pronouns work today. But let's just look at the standard, conventional way that things tend to work in a scenario like Shakespeare's. So in Shakespeare's day, the word she would be used in similar to how we would use the word they today. Today, if there was a woman, you know, one woman who identifies as a woman standing over here, I would maybe point to her and go, you know, she likes pizza. And I'd be talking about one person, right? I might even, you know, use the, if she didn't like, you know, that pronoun, I might point to the individual and call her they. But I would not do the thing that Shakespeare is doing, which is point to a group of five women who identify as women and call them she. I wouldn't say she likes pizza when I'm talking about five different people. Does that make sense? That's even, you know, in the world of slippery pronouns, not a thing that we do. But Shakespeare would have done it. So when Shakespeare says, you know, I think my love is rare as any she belied with false compare, he's talking about women as a group when he says she. He's saying, you know, I think my love is as rare as any other woman at all. We don't use she that way anymore. But of course, we use the word she, and we use it even kind of in a sentence like this. So it gets very confusing potentially. So you have to be very careful to be detail-oriented when you're reading. You have to read slowly. Sometimes you should read things multiple times. Not because, you know, the Shakespeare is trying to fool us and trick us. Just because it's very simple to get confused when people are using words just in a kind of non-normative or unusual way, which is fundamentally what poetry is. Poetry is using our everyday words in a strange manner so that, to produce strange effects. Now, I'm telling you this, but if you didn't have me to tell you this, you would have to go figure it out. So you would have to do research. You know, you would actually have to, you know, go find a dictionary, but not just any dictionary. You'd have to find a dictionary like, as an example, the Oxford English Dictionary, a dictionary that actually is going to tell you not just what a word means, but what a word has meant at different points in time. So we'd have to not just look at the word she in a dictionary if we were confused about how it was being used. We'd have to look at, like, in, you know, 1600s, how was the word she being used? So that's the thing that, you know, again, we're going to have to go and do research to determine. And in fact, if you were to, you know, find one of those more complicated dictionaries, you would look up another word that would be worth looking up here is wires. He says, if hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. I think that is a line that if you don't have a familiarity with Shakespeare and a familiarity with how literature worked in the, you know, 1600s, roughly, you would be hard-pressed to understand what that line means. It seems on the surface like the meaning is available to you. But again, there's a series of formal things that are happening. The very simple thing that is happening here on a formal level is you have a particular word being used, the word wires. And then you also have a word black as an adjective to modify the noun wires, black wires. So her hair is being described as black wires, okay? Now, if you think of a black wire today, you're of course going to think of like a computer wire or something, you know, that has a thickness to it, something that has a, you know, hardness perhaps to it, or it, you know, could easily become twisted and tangled. This is not how Shakespeare is talking about wires, right? A word like wires that seems to have a very clear and available meaning, and that seems to very cleanly denote something. This is the word, the technical term for when a word means a thing. Words denote things, right? I use the word wire to talk about the wire that's coming out of my computer cord, or this cord, you know, that connects into my computer. I use the word remote to talk about this remote. This machine, I should say, that I use to control my TV. Remote denotes this particular type of device. Bowl denotes this particular, you know, thing that I would, you know, use to put some popcorn in. But these words that we use all denote, they all directly refer to a thing. You know, when you say dog, it denotes a particular type of animal. But the other thing, though, that words do is they connote. They don't just denote, they connote. What a word connotes is a series of things that it suggests, or a series of other meanings that have collected to it. So when Shakespeare says black wires, you know, he refers to hair as black wires, or he says if hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. What he's saying there seems very simple. You know, if hairs are like wires, her hair is like black wires. That's the content. But the formal level, because he's used these particular words, starts to feed into a host of connotations or a host of associations that, again, mattered in Shakespeare's time and don't really matter in the same way today. So I'm going to back away from the content of this poem a little bit and tell you a little bit about the context where Shakespeare is producing this poem. So here again, we're looking at the formal level and we're asking, what is it? If you do some digging into English literature and you kind of get into the history of this kind of thing, a poem, of course, there's different types of poems. This is a particular type of poem called a blazon. That's B-L-A-S-O-N. A blazon is a poem that we don't see as so much of anymore, but is extremely common. We still see them, but it was extremely common in Shakespeare's time to write blazons. And a blazon is a poem where a woman's body is being talked about by comparing the parts of her body to different things. So a traditional and conventional blazon that, you know, Shakespeare would have known of would go like this. Your eyes are like the sun. Your lips are as red as coral. Your skin is as fair as snow. Your hair is like golden wires. The word wires at the time, in so far as it would be compared to hair, it didn't refer to like a thin, a fragile, flowing, you know, hair. This is the kind of wires that are talking about. So again, there's a particular kind of poetry, you know, one poetry coming down from that. There was a certain genre of poetry, the love poem, you know, a poem which you write to your lover or to express your love for a person. Then, you know, coming down a little narrower from that, a certain type of love poetry, the blazon, or different parts of a blazon would be written for a woman or about a woman. It would be talking about that woman's body in so far as, you know, this is supposedly a way to praise the woman and to display one's love. And we'd additionally be talking about that woman's body by comparing it to other things that were also meant to be, you know, beautiful. So when, you know, somebody writes, you know, your hair is like golden wires, that was considered to be praise and the height of beauty. Shakespeare is writing this poem in a context of where these are the cliches. These are the ways that people and poets have been writing about women for, you know, a long time at this point. And Shakespeare is writing a poem in a tradition, this particular tradition, where he's refusing that tradition. So keep this kind of, so in this sense, he's writing what we would consider an ironic blazon. Instead of doing the conventional blazon operation, you know, comparing parts of her body to beautiful things and then therefore suggesting your body is beautiful and so are you, my love is beautiful, I love you. Shakespeare's doing this ironic approach. He's saying, you know, your eyes aren't like the sun. Your lips aren't red as coral. You know what? Your hair is actually not golden. It's kind of black. Here's the weird thing that we wouldn't get today, but is very relevant when you're looking at a poem like this. Shakespeare is suggesting that his lover, the woman that he's writing about, has is not blonde. And therefore, he doesn't know, he can't, you know, say that her hair is blonde. That's a problem for him, because in the context of the time, the ideal of feminine beauty is such that you would never write a poem about a person who is not blonde. This is why, again, this hair, you know, he's describing her hair, her skin. He says, well, you know, her skin isn't, you know, white as snow. I know that's supposed to be the ideal of feminine beauty that, you know, I, as an English European, am kind of, you know, trapped in. She's got a bit of a tan, or, you know, actually, you know, kind of a browner skin tone to her skin. I still find it beautiful, but it's not the ideal of beauty. Now, does Shakespeare even have a real woman he's talking about in this way? You know, not necessarily. But the point being made here is that we have this particular tradition of how women are written about in poetry, and Shakespeare's writing against that tradition. He's kind of subverting it or undercutting it, again, by, he's taking the form of it. You know, he is writing a blazon. He is comparing her body to these different things. But instead of saying her looking good from the comparison, he's making her out to look bad. So now if you walk through the poem again, you can kind of see the operation and how his story, his poem is working. He starts with saying, you know, my mistress's eyes aren't like the sun. It's not, you know, it's nothing like the sun. Her lips, they're not quite as red as coral. You know, this, the skin of her chest is not as white as snow. You know, she doesn't have this fair, pale, snowy skin. Her hair is not, you know, thin and fine and golden wires. It's kind of, you know, black and wiry. Her cheeks aren't, you know, flush like pinkish like roses. Her breath doesn't smell like perfume. You know, I like to listen to her speak, but music sounds better. You know, I've never seen a goddess traveling around, but I've heard that, you know, when I read poems where other men praise their women, they talk about them as, you know, if they were floating along above the ground, not even touching it, because they're like goddesses. My mistress isn't like that, you know. She definitely walks on the ground. This is the content. You know, this is what he's actually, you know, saying. At the end, he turns it around. He says, and yet, you know, I may have seemed to have been insulting my mistress in this poem instead of praising her. That's what it seems like I've been doing. I understand that. If you put my poem beside the poem of somebody else talking about their, you know, mistress who has, you know, eyes like the sun and beautiful golden hair and so on. Yes, she doesn't seem quite as beautiful, I admit. She's not quite as beautiful as these other women that are being praised in poetry. And yet, you know, I think my love, by which he means, with that phrase, my love, he's, you know, has a double meaning, right? He's referring to the love that he feels and has, and also the love in the sense of my love, this woman, my wife, my mistress. My love is as rare as any she belied with false compare. What he means there is, so the direct, you know, communicative content level meaning of that line, now that we've kind of sussed out what those different things mean and how the word she is working, what he's saying there is, you know, and yet, you know, even though my mistress doesn't seem as perfect and rare and ideal a beauty as these other women that are talked about in poems. I think she's as rare as any other woman who is lied about using false comparisons. Here we have a sort of strange scenario. If we actually look closely at the content and the form, then, right? Again, we've got this content level where it seems like he's insulting this mistress, but then he's coming back around to the idea that actually I'm, you know, trying to suggest that I do love this woman. You know, I have a true love, not a fake love like these other poets seem to have. He's setting this poem up against and as the opposite of other poems in which women are, again, these blazons in which women's bodies are being praised in particular ways. If you isolate a line like, I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. What he's specifically saying in that particular line, if you look closely at it then, I love to hear her speak, is the first time in the poem where we get the suggestion that he actually likes something about his mistress. It's the first positive thing he's actually said, as opposed to negative. And I will ask you to note that when he says, I love to hear her speak, he's not talking in the blazon way anymore. He's, the blazon operation is to say, your voice is like music. He's saying, I like hearing you her speak, but her voice isn't like music. Again, look at what's happening in the traditional blazon versus what's happening here. There, instead of an emphasis on physical or even, in this case, the musical qualities of her voice, he's saying the content is what I like. Again, I think this is a useful poem to talk about form and content because we get inside the poem itself this thematic discussion of form and content. He suggests in that line, what matters to me when she speaks is what she says, not the pretty package that, you know, maybe could be wrapped up in it. Yes, her voice could sound better, but what I love is that she's saying something that is meaningful or that I want to listen to or, you know, whatever. She has something to say. That's what I love about her, not so much how good her voice sounds. What eventually, you know, Shakespeare is trying to suggest here in this whole poem is that there's this tradition of poetry in which women are talked about in a particular way. This one, not real women, but this ideal female beauty is under discussion. And the ideal of female beauty is being praised. But no women actually match this ideal of female beauty. Some women aren't blonde. You know, some women, you know, who are beautiful don't have white skin, snowy white skin. Some women who are beautiful have things to say. They don't just have a voice that sounds good. There's a way in which the physical or the formal aspects of their, you know, bodies, which are the focus typically of male praise, are maybe not the things that fundamentally men should be praising. There's a suggestion here that there's a couple ways to look at this particular poem by Shakespeare and different attitudes you can take towards it. So one sort of way to think about it here is it's a poem that in many respects seems to be about, on the surface level, again, it's in a bit of an ironic poem because it seems to be about this mistress that he's talking about. But really, what he's complaining about is how poets write. He's sort of on a surface level complaining, you know, poets aren't doing a good job praising their women because they're using all these cliches. All their women sound the same. It's as if, you know, you have 100 poems praising 100 women, but they all sound identical. Well, my mistress is more rare. She's not only as rare, she's maybe more rare than the other women because the woman I'm talking about is a unique individual, not one of these other people who is being lied about using false comparisons. So it's a love poem that is, again, operating in an ironic fashion because it seems to be criticizing and complaining and, you know, denigrating this woman, when in fact it's meant to be supporting uplifting, and actually, you know, praising her. He's suggesting that my love is real. Other poets, other types of love that are more focused on the physical, are false.